It's a lovely spring morning in Studio City, California, and we're beside the pool at the Sportsman's Lodge, and we're delighted to have as our guest Tommy Cook, a man who was not a man when he started in radio back in the golden days. He was a young boy. Tommy, welcome, and thanks for being here today.
Well, I'm honored to be with you, Chuck. Thanks for inviting me.
You were just 8 years old when you started in radio.
Yes, about 1938. I started in radio. I was more or less discovered by the legendary writer, producer, director Arch Obler.
Ah.
And they had at NBC at that time an artist service. Miss May Regan, God bless her, was the head of the artist service. And my mother had filled out a questionnaire in a magazine and sent it in. And so they had my name, and I was called in to audition for a radio show for Arch Obler. And I got the role only because I was the youngest sounding child there. And Arch wanted a very, very young boy. So I didn't even know what a cue was. My mother had to pay the page $5 to tell me what a microphone was and where to stand. They had to get a special box to put me on. But anyway, it was the beginning of a truly wonderful and memorable time for me in radio. At NBC and with Arch Obler. As you well know, Chuck, the three great radio writer, producer, directors, the David Lean, Steven Spielbergs in the picture business in the hallowed days of radio were Norman Corwin, Orson Welles, and Arch Obler.
Yes,
I had the privilege of working with all three. Of course, I'm prejudiced because Arch started me, and I was starred six times by Arch on his shows, Plays for Americans, Every Man's Theater, all of which won numerous national awards. Arch probably won more awards for his writing and directing than all of them. I recall vividly one show that I was starred on called Problem Papa, and would you believe Howard Duff played my father, and Mercedes McCambridge played my mother, and Gordon Jenkins did the music, and Elliot Lewis and Lou Merrill and Byron Kane and people like that, the all-time greats, were playing featured roles. So I worked with the greatest stars of all time.
Had you wanted to be on radio when you were 8 years old?
Well, I can only tell you what my parents told me. Coming from Minnesota, when I was 4 or 5 years old, my grandmother had Parkinson's disease, and they tell me that I used to dress up in funny outfits and sing and dance and play around and sort of entertain her. I don't remember that. And then at a benefit that I attended with my father, I supposedly, when I was 5 years old, got on top of the table and started prancing around. My mother always loved the theater, never for herself as an actress, but when a repertory company would come to Duluth, Minnesota, can you believe, she would go backstage and invite all the actors to come over to the house for tea and stuff because she loved the theater. And so she felt that I might have a little talent. And when we came out to California for my father's help, I went over and auditioned and did seven straight plays at the very famous Pasadena Playhouse.
Yes.
And that's where I got my first formal training. And then at the age of eight, the audition in radio through the NBC Artist Bureau and starting out with Arch Obler. It was something that was totally natural for me. Totally spontaneous. And I'll tell you something interesting. Arch Obler understood me so well. He would not let me woodshed, would not let me take the scripts home. He wanted that natural. He knew I was a quick reader, and he knew I had a total understanding of the character, and he did not want me to rehearse. And I wouldn't even get to do the show until the dress rehearsal. And so it was almost going on cold, but that's what he wanted, that fresh, natural, spontaneous performance.
You must have been a good sight reader then.
Yes, I was a very good sight reader. Mm-hmm. And one of the first roles I got in motion pictures is because I could read better than any other kid. And yes, I was a fast reader, but I was more or less of a natural. I never really had any formal training. In those days, you know, our training was working.
Yeah. Yes.
In the old days for the great actors, they would do repertory, they would do stage. plays around the country. That was their training, not going to the Actor's Studio and Sandy Meisner in New York and Daryl Hickman here in Hollywood. By the way, Daryl Hickman, I grew up with Daryl, one of the great actors, child actors, who's now a very, very fine drama coach. But we didn't have those in those days. So radio was my training ground, but I had a natural feeling for it. It was a love, and it was something that I enjoyed. I really did.
Well, you were pretty busy then. Once you got started with Arch.
I was under contract to all three major networks at the same time, CBS, NBC, and CBS. I was, once I really got started, I was the original Little Beaver in the Red Ryder radio series. I was also the original Little Beaver in the films with the late Don Redberry before Robert Blake, and who I also grew up with. What a wonderful technician Robert has proved to be. But so that was on the ABC, they called the Blue Network at that time. Yeah. And at the same time, I was under contract to the Red Network, NBC, and I did the Life of Riley radio show. I played Junior in the Life of Riley for about 4.5 years. At the same time, I was under contract to CBS doing the Blondie radio show. I was Dagwood and Blondie's son, Alexander, and did that show for about 3.5 years. So I was practically lived at the radio stations in Hollywood, Sunset and Vine and Sunset and Gower. I took 6 buses each day, 3 going and 3 coming, the transfers, you know, and buses. But at nighttime, I guess my folks would pick me up because I was pretty small in the early ages, and they didn't want me to take buses. But later on, I would take buses going and coming. I spent all my time at the radio stations.
As a youngster, you were taking a bus from home after school to the studios?
I would take it from the school and right to the stations. And when I was old enough, I would take the buses back home. But when I was very young, my folks, of course, when we're talking about 8, 9, 10, until I was 12 or 13 years old, my mother, who more or less gave up her life help my career, would provide the transportation.
Was she a stage mother?
No.
Would you say?
My mother was not a stage mother. There is no worse venom in this world than a stage mother. And I used to tell my mom, especially when I was doing a film, and she was required by law to be on the set, and I had to have 4 hours of school on the set, but not in radio. Didn't need to have an adult with you when you were doing radio. They had the different laws. But on the movie set, I would tell my mother, I said, you do your knitting, your crocheting, mother, and I don't ever want to see you going to a director or producer or saying how wonderful your son is, and you stay away from those other mothers of children and just do your thing and don't ever talk about me, because I hated stage mothers. But no, she was wonderful. She kept her place, and she was not a stage mother.
Well, when you were in school, were you going to public school?
I always stayed in public school. I had opportunities. They told me I should go to private schools because that's where all the show business children went. But I wanted the social democracy, the normal democracy of being with normal kids in a school. It was very difficult, very difficult. I remember in high school, at Los Angeles High School, I received a D in Spanish, and I was an excellent Spanish student. And I was furious, and I went with my mother to the principal and demanded why I was receiving a D. And they brought in the teacher, and the teacher said, because Mr. Cook was never in class. Yes, he did do his tests, and he got A's and B's, but I gave him an F every time he wasn't in class. So that's what I had to contend with. But I graduated with good grades at junior high and high school, and even I was still doing radio when I went to UCLA.
Did you have difficulty with school? I mean, did you have a problem being absent from school to do some radio work?
Now, most of the teachers were wonderful and understood, and the kids understood. What I missed, I was able to bridge that problem. But what I did miss was not being a part of, again, I use that word, that democracy of being with kids my own age, you know, and having that normal life. However, look at all the assets. Look, traveling around the world, working with the people on my right here, like Les Tremaine, working with the most talented people and creative people in the world. And I will always, to this day, say to anyone that the finest people and the most brilliant actors I ever worked with were in radio.
Mm-hmm.
Radio.
Radio.
Yep.
You had much contact with older people when
yes,
you were a youngster.
That's right.
Although in those great radio days, everybody was a lot younger.
Yes, but Les and Elliot Lewis, uh-huh. the all-time great, and Howard Duff and Frank Lovejoy, mm-hmm. and you know all the great radio stars. Even though they were young, they were a heck of a lot older than
yeah.
I was.
Well, how did they treat you?
Wonderfully. Wonderfully. They were wonderful to my mother, too. And the most wonderful moments were to see the look of pride on my folks, you know, when they'd pick me up at a tender age and I'd sit on my mom's lap as my dad would be driving me home after a radio show. They were so proud. I think those were the happiest times of my life. And for my folks, too.
Did you ever feel that you weren't part of the group with the older folks working on the radio? Because you were most often the youngest one around.
No, because the camaraderie between actors, the age had nothing to do with wonderful. There was terrific respect. I adored working with everyone. People like Mercedes McCambridge was very close to my mother. They were confidants. And they always treated me with great respect and were just wonderful to me. I mean, when I was doing the Red Rider show, we would go to the Brown Derby in Hollywood, the famous Brown Derby, uh-huh. and I would go with the cast at least twice a week. We did the radio show Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays, and at least twice a week we would all go as a group there. And, you know, they were like my second family. I never had a problem with the adult actors.
Tell us a little bit about the life of Riley. You worked with William Bendix and Paula Winslow.
Yeah, good for you. Yeah. Paula, what a dear. Again, very close to my mother and to me. The nicest woman in the world and one of the fine radio actresses. William Bendix was wonderful. Totally. The entire cast of that show. The late John Brown, who played Digger O'Dell.
Yes.
They were all just wonderful. And we were close to the writers, Irving Brecker, who was the creator mm-hmm. and producer of the show and one of the co-writers. They were all, it was just a happy, happy experience.
How did you have to, tell us a little bit of how that show got on the air. When did you get the first script?
Well, that was interesting. I wasn't the original junior. I believe that either, I grew up mm-hmm. with two wonderful young child actors. As I mentioned before, Daryl Hickman and the late Scotty Beckett. Mm-hmm. Scotty was one of the top young picture actors. I had a tragic life later on. But I can't recall, but it was either Daryl or Scotty, who weren't really into the radio genre like I was. Mm-hmm. They were basically picture actors, and there's a big difference.
Yes.
You know, I can remember Gary Cooper on radio. He couldn't even, he didn't know his own name, you know. But in pictures, uh-huh. that naturalness, you know, and naivety was brilliant, you know. But he was terrible as a radio actor. But anyway, I had the feel for radio, and either Daryl or Scotty did the first show or two, and something wasn't right, and they called me in, and then I auditioned, and I became junior from then on. So it was just a matter of auditioning.
But in a week's program, any kind of a week, at what day before the broadcast did you get the script? And what did you do up until broadcast
yes,
time?
Yes.
And these were all live shows.
Right.
Too.
For most of the radio shows mm-hmm. is that you were brought in 3 or 4 days early to read the mm-hmm. first draft script. And we would read it around the table. And we might do it then on the mic. And that would be it. And then we would come back on the day of the broadcast. There would be changes made in the script. And we would then do it with sound and for time. And then we would make cuts and additions. And we would get our comments and our criticisms from the radio director. And we would do then, you know, in those days, two shows.
Yes.
We'd go on at 4:30 or 5 o'clock for the East Coast and come back at 8 o'clock, 7:30 at night and do it for the West Coast.
That's when you went to the Brown Derby. You between,
oh, I can tell you all kinds of experiences. On Lux Radio Theater, we had the most rehearsals. And that was one of the top-paying shows for scale. Uh-huh. Of course, when I was under contract, the amount of monies that we made in those days were not significant compared to what you made in films. Of course, I received more monies being under contract as a steady member of a show. But when you just receive scale, the Lux Radio show paid more because they had all kinds of rehearsals. Number one, it was an hour show. Mm-hmm. And number two, at least 3 or 4 days of different rehearsals going on to the day of the show. And the day of the show, it was like an all-day situation. I can remember once, I won't divulge the name of my fellow young child radio actor, but it was a show Lux Radio Theater, as you know, recreations of motion pictures.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I think this was the Pied Piper or some show that Roddy McDowell starred in. Roddy was on the show and another British actor. And there were 3 or 4 young child actors, including myself, obviously. And I noticed that this one little kid was not feeling well. And during the actual show, they had a basement area for restrooms and for a lounge underneath the or below the stage area. And the kid didn't show up for the second act. He wasn't there. And I noticed it, and I quickly went in, and I played his role besides my own. It's just something that I recall.
Now, would you try to disguise your voice or change a higher or lower register?
That's so far back. I was using an English accent at that time, and I can't really tell you to what degree I disguised it. I couldn't have been more than 10 or 11 or 12 years old at that time. But conversely, I can tell you when Mercedes McCambridge took over for me, she was playing a role in the Red Ryder radio series, done at NBC, at Sunset and Vine. And just before the show, I'm in the men's room doing cartwheels and standing on my head. And I can't get out of the... I finally come down to my feet, and the door is jammed. I can't get out of the door, and the show goes on. At the beginning of each show, it says, from the Adventures of Red Ryder, here comes... And then the Adventures of Red Ryder. And then you hear the thundering claps of the hoofs. And Red Ryder says, come on, thunder. And then Little Beaver's supposed to say, get him up, Papoose. And I'm not there, and Mercedes sees that I'm not there, and she goes out and plays Little Beaver and does it with the Indian accent until I can finally get my way out of the bathroom and run down into Studio G and get in,
Where is that kid, huh?
Then I can remember an instance during the commercial. Langendorf Bread was the commercial. Yeah. And Dane Clark was a guest. At that time, his name was Bernard Zanville, before he became a star at Warner Brothers. He was playing a heavy on the show. And during dress rehearsal, we were kidding around. We had a great rapport. And during dress rehearsal, I can recall, because I was a devil, I was a little terror, I started tickling him. And he laughed during a line in dress rehearsal. And sure enough, during the show, Red Ryder and I are in the commercial talking about Langendorf Bread. And I'm saying, ooh, Langendorf and Bread, you betcha'm good. Me like him, real good. And Dane Clark, Bernie Zanville, starts making faces at me. And I start laughing during the commercial. I don't think they like that too much. So I wasn't the most angelic kid. I did all kinds of crazy things.
How did you get along with Penny Singleton and Arthur Lake?
I loved them, and they were they were wonderful. But I adored Arthur Lake. I followed him around like a shadow, and he had a tradition every week. Arthur was that character. At least the day of the show on Sunday, Arthur Lake was Dagwood. And after rehearsal, he would still be the character. He says, I can't find my bow tie. He had to dress up, even though it was radio. He had to dress up with the bow tie and the suit and everything. And we did it at CBS at Gower and Sunset. And I was just 2 blocks from Columbia Studios where they filmed the Blondie film series. I wasn't the little Alexander, baby dumpling, as they called it originally, and then Alexander. Larry Sims wasn't. Mm-hmm. But anyway, he said, I've got to get my outfit. So I would run with him. And we would literally run across the street into Columbia Studios, and he would go in. He had the key, would go into his dressing room and get his bow tie and his outfit, and he would come up, and I would follow him up. And he said, I can't get this bow tie on. We'd go into the bathroom, and he'd find a paper clip, and he would tie it with a paper clip, and he would barely get out when it was time. He would open the show by saying, Blondie, you know, he would give that scream, and then he would go, ha, 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 with that laugh, you know, and he would just barely make it onto the stage, you know, when the audience would applaud, and he would scream out Blondie. But that was the ritual every week, never would change, and of course, I'm his shadow, following him every way, and of course, I would wear the bow tie, and so we had that kind of a relationship, where I idolized him.
It was a great show. A good show.
We were honored on the Pacific Pioneers broadcast luncheon a few years ago. Penny Singleton was out of state, and she sent a telegram of her regrets. But we were basically honoring the show and Arthur Lake, and I was on the dais. And Viola Vaughn, mm-hmm. who was the wife of the...
Mrs. Dithers, I think.
Yes, Mrs. Dithers, Hanley Stafford.
Hanley Stafford,
who was not only Mr. Dithers mm-hmm. on the Blondie show, but he was Fanny Bryce's
daddy.
Yeah. And I used to play Fanny Bryce's boyfriend. That was Studio A, the big Studio A, where Danny Thomas first got his start, was brought from Ohio. One of the first things he did was a comedy routine on the Fanny Bryce Hour from CBS. But I used to rush over from Studio C doing the Blondie show, and I would sneak over and have a few lines and play her boyfriend and then sneak back and do the Blondie show. But Hanley Stafford was totally brilliant, and he used to write most of his lines. He would rewrite all his material to make it sound funnier, both on the Blondie show and
Baby Snooks,
yeah. Right. And so Viola Vaughn, who was gorgeous, gorgeous, wonderful woman, and she was on the dais, and also, help me on the names, the tall woman, Elvia Allman was on the dais, but it brought back nice memories. But it was nice to be honored by the Pacific Pioneer broadcasters.
In at one point, did you work with the Smiling Ed McConnell and
yes.
the Buster Brown gang?
How did you know that?
I have ways.
June Ferre, who ended up marrying Hobie Donovan, who was the writer-director. I used to get up at 6 in the morning, and I think our show would go on at 7 or 8 o'clock in the morning, and the studio would be filled with all these young little kids. And, we would recreate the stories. I'm Buster Brown. I come in a shoe. Come and buy me. I'll say hello to you, too, or something like that. But we would do that at NBC on Saturday mornings. Mm-hmm. Yes, Smiling Ed McConnell. He was a wonderful, charismatic kind of host.
You had a good relationship then with Squeaky the Mouse and Froggy the Gremlin.
Oh, gosh. Great.
Tommy Cook, what are you doing today?
Well, today I'm still involved in show business. On the other side of the camera most of the time, I have a sports company, and I produce celebrity and pro-celebrity sports events for major charities at beautiful venues all over the world. And I've sort of created and started this way back in 1970 for the first motion picture and television tennis championships at La Costa, a wonderful resort near in the Southern California area. And over the years, I've been able to make literally millions for all kinds of charities. They're mostly tennis events, but there are a lot of golf, some celebrity polo, board sailing, softball, different sports events. I use the cream of the celebrities that love the sport of tennis and golf. Everyone from a Clint Eastwood to a Chuck Heston, to a Robert Duvall, to a Gene Wilder, to an Elkie Summer, Donna Mills. I'm taking six wonderful stars next week to Ecuador for the Pancho Segura Celebrity Tournament. That's his home, where he learned to play the game in Guayaquil. And then a memorable trip to the Galapagos Islands. And I'm taking Christy McNichol. I'm taking Michael Nader from Dynasty. I'm taking Mimi Rogers. I'm taking Donna Mills. I'm taking Franco Nero, the Italian star. I would be taking Michael Landon, but with the total tragedy, I don't think with his new chemotherapy that he'll be able to attend, but he wanted to, and even when he contacted cancer, he still had it on his agenda that he wanted to take his two small children, be one of, you know, a nice fitting trip that he wanted to spend. I don't believe that his doctors will allow him to go to the Galapagos. and possibly Eric Estrada. So I have a nice group of people that I'm taking for that event. But when the event, the magnitude is great enough, we also put together television specials. I always MC my events, and sometimes I do play-by-play, and so I still have a chance to utilize my old radio training. I'm working with celebrities. I'm producing events, so I'm still very much a part of the industry. But my main love over the years, the past few years, is creating picture and television projects. I've created two films. Mm-hmm. One, wrote the original story and sold personally the film Roller Coaster, was produced at Universal, and the tennis film Players that I sold to Robert Evans, in which I was associate producer. I directed the second unit, the tennis sequences, and I brought in all the pros myself and choreographed the tennis sequences. And I also created and co-owned a television series that was on for a couple of seasons at CBS called The Challenge of the Sexes. I'm the one that originally created the man versus woman, Bobby Riggs versus Billie Jean King. Yes, I originally signed him in 1971. And although I couldn't get it on television, Bobby Riggs did the smart thing. He issued a challenge through the press to the top women, and that's how it came alive. But I got the last laugh. I was able to put the Challenge of the Sexes on television, in which we won some awards. And from that, it went into the Celebrity Challenge of the Sexes with the two-hour primetime specials on CBS, the first show of which was the highest-rated show of the week, the show in which Bill Cosby played tennis against Farrah Fawcett.
Oh, boy.
That was the highest-rated show of the week.
It's amazing you've been able to stay in show business all of your life.
Show business and sports have been my life.
Yeah.
I started right. I thank my ma for starting me in show business, and thank my mother's brother, my lawyer, my uncle, Maxie Gilmore, who's 92. Would you believe my mother is 91 and my uncle is 92, still a practicing attorney at Hollywood and Vine for over 60 years. He started me teaching me tennis and horseback riding. So it's sort of been a family unit.
Well, before you go, I want to thank you for the work you did on radio. You entertain a lot of us. And
It still brings moisture to my eyes, the nicest times I've ever had in my life.
Well, we appreciate that. On behalf of all your fans, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.